Welcome to episode 19 of The Infectious Myth. Today, for a change, we're going to do the same thing as last week, talk about nonsense science. Today, however, my guest is Dr. Henry Bauer, a professor emeritus of Virginia Tech and a former dean there. More importantly, he has scientifically dissected what we call science, and especially the groupthink that he calls scientism. But before we get to Dr. Bauer, I want to remind you that you can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. And now here is a pause where I would be happy in future episodes to recognize any people who would like to donate to this show. This is journalism, and if you help support the time I put into this show, I will be able to spend more time, do more research, and be even better than I have been in the past, which I hope you think is pretty good. If you can't afford to help out, I still want you to listen, but if you want independent radio to succeed, you should consider supporting it. So send me an email. Last week, I interviewed Dr. Simon Silver of the University of Illinois at Chicago, and following that, a listener, Rob Schleifer, took the time to write a very detailed response. I'll read just part of it before I get to Dr. Bauer. I took time out from work today to listen to your interview. And as an aside, I certainly appreciate people who skip work to listen to this show. If you can't skip work, you can listen to it afterwards as a podcast. He goes on, Dr. Simon Silver, in his own semi-quiet way, seems to think that he and he alone knows what is right or wrong. And those things he considers wrong, he unequivocally calls nonsense. He seems to have a very high opinion of himself and did not hesitate on numerous occasions to point out that he believed you were making less than 100% factual statements, which I found a little condescending. In all, I think you were too gentle with him, which is why you are doing this show and not me. I would have probably lost my cool on more than one occasion. When, for example, he claimed that Duisberg shot himself in the foot and for 20 or 25 years was barking up the wrong tree, according to Dr. Silver, everyone knows that HIV causes AIDS, and the discussion should now be whether that one single pill he mentioned can be effective in treating or curing AIDS. I would have certainly gone after him at that point. I would have also challenged Dr. Silver on his repeated statements that Gallo made several very important contributions. As far as I know, Gallo stole everything he ever did in his life from others and only pretended to make contributions. So I would have said, can you please tell me what contributions Gallo made that were not taken from other researchers? And I would have followed through on every one of your guests' answers, since he clearly does not know what he is talking about when it comes to AIDS. As far as the issue of Gallo announcing the probable cause of AIDS before publishing on the subject, I would have informed your guest that Gallo clearly called his April 23, 1984 news conference to make the announcements before the French, such as Luc Montagné, whom Gallo had secretly agreed with to issue a collective statement. And Gallo also wanted to make the announcement before his publication in Science in order to circumvent his peers from criticizing his paper, as they had criticized virtually all of his earlier papers about retroviruses. So this was Gallo's way to create a fait accompli. I would therefore have said to your guest, if you permit me, I would like to educate you on this topic. But having said all of this, you did an excellent job here and there of pressing your guest for answers. For example, pushing him about the inconsistency that if HIV causes AIDS, one can have antibodies to a disease in their blood, but no disease associated with those antibodies, as he acknowledged. Then how can you use that antibody test to determine if one presently has an HIV infection? And his only answer to that inconsistency was to start talking about the PCR test, and of which you quickly corrected him on the chronology of testing. But undeterred, he continued to utter more nonsense on the topic, such as, and I'm paraphrasing here, we need to do more tests so that the person is better controlled, or something like that. Anyway, thank you for your comments, Rob Schleifer, and I certainly will take those under consideration, and I think we can start today's discussion from this point. So, Dr. Bauer, you are with us.
Yeah, I am. You didn't try it via Skype?
I asked them to connect you via Skype. I'll ask them.
If we can switch, it would be easier. But anyway, we can start this way.
Yes. So basically, the reason I talked to Simon Silver last week was this question of, is there science that is so absurd that we shouldn't talk about it? I mean, what is your position on where the boundary is between what's acceptable to discuss and what should be shunned?
I think, in general, if there are competent people who suggest something, then there is no contemporary way in which you can dismiss it as obviously absurd. By long hindsight, you can say that people were on a wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of the things I didn't like about Silver's piece was that he was, by hindsight, saying that it should have been obvious earlier. That's an approach that has been discussed a lot by professional historians, and they call it pejoratively Whiggish history, attempting to judge what happened in the past by what we know nowadays.
Right. I mean, I'm sure everybody who's been in a traffic accident has said, if only I left home 5 minutes later or 5 minutes earlier, never would have happened. But, of course, you can't possibly know that kind of thing. And it is very easy, especially, you know, in the context of science, to say, well, we all now know, for example, that the continents move, called plate tectonics, and a lot of geology is based on that. But prior to the 1960s, that was a discussion that was pretty much forbidden in geology departments, and it obviously wasn't so obvious to geologists back then.
Right. And there is a huge literature, actually, in the history and philosophy of science, which documents that some of the greatest scientific advances that we praise nowadays, at the time when they were proposed, they met strong resistance from what was then the mainstream consensus, which a Simon Silver of the past would have strongly upheld.
Yes. It almost seems obvious looking back that you know, if I was well educated in classical physics around the turn of the last century, and Einstein came up to me and started talking about time slowing down and light bending because of gravity and all the other crazy things that he talked about, I would have said he was crazy.
Yeah, and One of the things that many people probably don't know about Einstein is that when he got a Nobel Prize around 1920 or so, that prize was not for the theory of relativity. And in fact, the Nobel Prize citation at the time emphasized that it was for his work on the photoelectric effect and Brownian motion, and that the question of relativity was still moot.
Yes. In fact,
there had been powerful voices in physics that did not accept his theory of relativity ideas at all.
Well, let me give you an example of somewhere where there's been some recent discussion. I can't remember the name of this scientist, but he's claiming and has claimed for some time that there's a correlation between race and intelligence. And it's interesting to me because a lot of your work has been, well, not a lot, but you've worked on the issue of testing HIV positive and race. And so the question is, should we ban people from talking about the connection between, say, race and intelligence because we suspect that at heart they're racists and they want to prove that non-white people are not as intelligent?
I'm not in favor of banning discussion on anything. Mm-hmm. But on issues of race, I think it's terribly important to make a distinction between what the genetic basis is and what the popular view of race is.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very, I think it was about 50, 60 years ago that the anthropologist Ruth Benedict wrote a book in which she emphasized that race is a matter of biology and racism is a matter of social attitudes and politics and so on. I mean, what we know about a way that you can define race is in terms of, it's usually defined in terms of visible characteristics.
Right.
And it remains an open question, the degree to which that correlates with behavioral things.
And, well, particularly in the United States, where, you know, the government has arbitrarily come up with several categories, if I'm correct,
right.
White, Hispanic, Black, a Native American, Native Hawaiian, and maybe one or two others. But the term Hispanic seems to me to be a pretty vague and non-biological classification,
I mean,
right?
The classification, I think, was made for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the troubles it ran into immediately was defining a category Hispanic, which is not a racial category. And so in some cases, they now have to distinguish between white and non-white Hispanics.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, my problem with people who try to study race and intelligence is that I don't think it's possible to precisely define race, except amongst groups of people who, for whatever reason, have been very insular and very much in one place for a very long time. And secondly, measuring intelligence in a context that's separate from culture seems also impossible.
Well, I think the problem of trying to define intelligence is even worse than the problem of trying to define race. But
yeah.
I mean, in the HIV-AIDS correlation with race, as with any racial correlations, you got to realize it's a probabilistic one,
right?
And you have a some sort of a distribution, and it's not a one-to-one relationship ever. And the worst aspect of racism is the categorizing everybody who looks a certain way as having all of the stereotypical characteristics associated with that racial category. And,
right,
and
at the
that's
very
simply not valid.
Right, at the very best, you could come up with two heavily overlapping bell curves. And
exactly.
The majority of people would be in the overlapping portion, so you really couldn't tell very much. And to do something like saying that somebody who is a particular race or somebody who is male or female should not study a certain thing because we know that they can't understand it would be an absurd use of such information.
Yeah.
Is one of the problems the very word science itself? Like, let me give you an example. I interviewed recently an anthropologist who wrote a blog post on vaccination, and as far as I could tell, there was nothing in her scientific background that had anything to do with vaccination except, you know, general biology, I'm sure, that she studied in the past. But she wrote a very strong black and white piece on vaccination saying that everything about vaccination is good. Everybody who criticizes vaccination, even in a minor way, is wrong. And I think the fact that she considers herself a scientist encouraged her to wade into a completely different area of science and make some pretty strong statements because of this. Do you see a lot of...
I think that's an important point, really, that one of the things that you do pretty much automatically when you're doing science is that you trust everybody else who's doing any sort of science, whether it overlaps with yours or not.
Right.
And, you know, as a practical matter, you have to do that, because if you're trying to push ahead, you cannot yourself look into every nook and cranny of things that you might want to use. So trust is, is automatically granted. But that also tends to make you too dogmatic about things. And there may be cases where you can say something with absolute certainty, but I don't know that there are all that many of them. And, for instance, with vaccination, where I have not looked into it deeply at all, but one of the things that I believe is accepted is that no matter how effective a vaccine for a particular thing may be, there are some people who will have negative reactions to it. And that's something that should not be totally ignored. I think personally that there's probably very good evidence that some vaccinations, like for smallpox, for example, seem to have been really effective. On the other hand, I think that the accepted effectiveness of those vaccinations has now led to an extrapolation that is quite invalid, like the Gardasil cervarix vaccines that are supposedly against cervical cancer.
Well, even the measles vaccine, I mean, there's another question there, because, I mean, I'm sure you probably had measles. I did in the early 1960s. I was off school for a couple of days, had a bunch of spots, had a fever, and then I went on with lifetime immunity. And yet with the measles vaccine, they've discovered that one vaccine doesn't work, so they had to do two. And even after two vaccines, they discovered major outbreaks of measles in vaccinated populations. So it seems like there's a whole bunch of questions to be asked about a vaccine that doesn't seem to work and prevents an illness that is really quite minor.
Yeah.
I mean, do we vaccinate for the common cold even if, you know, 1 out of 10,000 people die from the vaccine? There's some interesting questions that arise.
Well, I was interested just within the last couple of years that a perfectly mainstream source, which I can't now cite, but mentioned that actually 90% of what is called flu nowadays is not the sort of influenza against which the flu vaccine works.
Well, yeah, that's been known for quite some time. I haven't heard 90%, but I remember reading in a mainstream journal that only 25% of people who have flu-like symptoms actually have an influenza virus detectable in them, which would mean on that statistic that, you know, you'd still get 3/4 of the illnesses that you would have got if you hadn't got vaccinated. So how much of a benefit is that?
Yeah.
Especially if there's some problems. What are some of the other historical things in science where the establishment has been very strongly opposed to certain ideas, and the establishment has later proved to be terribly wrong?
Well, the classic paper that I like to cite by sociologist Bernard Barber, in 1961, he listed a whole bunch of really famous people who nowadays, I mean, they're praised nowadays, but they had a heck of a time when they put forward their ideas. I remember Ohm, for example.
Right. We
use his name now as the unit of resistance. But
right.
Not only a whole bunch of people resisted at the time, a couple of classic cases, you mentioned continental drift.
Mm-hmm.
That and Mendel's laws of heredity were ignored or rejected for something like 4 or 5 decades
right.
before it was recognized that there were genuine insights there.
I think that often these theories are prevented from acceptance for about the lifespan, the working lifespan of a scientist. I know that when I read on Continental Drift, is a good book I mentioned last time by Naomi Oreskes on the scientists who were around at the time that things flipped over. But there was one proponent of the static Earth who came up very strongly against continental drift in around 1913 when Wegener published on continental drift. And it was about the time of his death, he lived a very long life, in the 1960s, that the whole opposition to continental drift fell apart. And it seems like he personally had a huge impact in sort of stabilizing resistance to this to these new ideas about a dynamic Earth.
Yeah, I mean, what I've gathered about that is that one of the strong reasons why people wouldn't accept the idea was that they couldn't see any origin of a force that would be powerful enough to move the continents.
Right.
And then sometime, I think, in the 1950s, or perhaps 1960s, when measurements were made of magnetism across the oceans, discovered these parallel stripes and realized that there were actually plates on which the continents rest, and they were being pushed apart.
Yes, yeah, it became, but it was interesting that it was not geologists, trying to study that. It was. I think it was done for military purposes to work, look at the magnetism of the seafloor. I presume something to do with submarines. It was probably top secret at first. But that's interesting. I thought it would be, you mentioned that Ohm, who's now famous for resistance the measurement of electrical resistance, now the unit is the ohm, that maybe we should create a new unit, also called the ohm, which measures the resistance to scientific progress. That would... We could call it the ohm, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is going to be a permanent feature. I mean, it only stands to reason, not just in science, but in every field where people have beliefs, very often, for fairly sound reasons, and will be suspicious of anything that seems to overturn them.
Yes.
In science, many people will quote Thomas Kuhn, who introduced the concept of scientific revolutions. But I think Kuhn is very often quoted in a misleading way, in the sense of that you have these revolutionary advances.
Right.
But what Kuhn actually showed was that the revolutions were rejecting of previous mainstream consensus.
Right. So it's not like all of the biologists or physicists sort of have a conference and say, you know, we've gone as far as we can with, say, with classical physics. We need something else. It's like somebody comes along and crashes the party and says, you're all wrong, and I'm right, and this is the new theory. And everybody says, right. Who are you?
Yes. And things have become much worse because maybe two or three centuries ago, which people call the beginnings of modern science, it was a pursuit followed by amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, people's whole careers and lives are vested in the research that they're doing. So conflicts of interest exist nowadays that didn't exist in earlier times. And that makes it even more difficult to get people to contemplate the possibility that they've gone wrong in some way.
Right. And although, I don't know if you've read the book Longitude, which is about the development or the British Navy's attempt to find a mechanism to determine longitude accurately on their ships because they were having too many ships get lost. They didn't know how far east or west they were. They could tell how far north or south they were through the height of the sun, et cetera, but they couldn't tell very easily how far east or west they were.
Right.
And so they had a number of serious accidents. But when the clockmaker, and I'm afraid I can't remember his name, said that what we need is an accurate chronometer and proved that you could calculate latitude and you could calculate longitude with an accurate clock, there was tremendous resistance. And a few years ago, I was in the Greenwich Observatory in London, England, and they had a little... they had one of his clocks there or something. But it seems to me, reading the description of the clock, that they still had their nose out of joint a little bit because he came from far outside the naval establishment. And the more they resisted, of course, the bigger the embarrassment was when they finally had to accept that he was right, some unknown clockmaker from Yorkshire.
Right.
So I guess human nature hasn't changed. But it seems to me, like judging by my discussions with Simon Silver and also this anthropologist Jennifer Raff, that there's a tendency in science to see things in black or white terms and also to see a huge distinction between insiders and outsiders, like people with a science PhD and people who don't have a science PhD.
Yeah.
And to resist anything that comes from people who don't have the right credentials.
Well, I mean, you don't like to be contradicted, and if it comes from some outsider, that's a nice excuse to give yourself for not taking it seriously.
Right, right. But it seems like scientists like to retreat behind absolutism. You know, I think with HIV and AIDS, it's a classic example because you have to believe absolutely in every part of the theory in order for the whole thing to hang together. You can't have doubts about, for example, the accuracy of the HIV test because then have to say... Go ahead.
I think it would be essentially impossible to really push ahead with research if you're having doubts all the time. You know, I think a characteristic of many of the people who've made major advances is that they were intensely stubborn, self-centered, egotistical people. And you have to be like that if you're going to overcome the skepticism and resistance of your colleagues.
But isn't that also, that same characteristic also appears to be true of the establishment, that they're very stubborn and resistant to change. So that, for example, if you want to talk about HIV testing, they'll go behind statistics generated by the manufacturers of the tests, so the tests are 99.9% accurate.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you went to Coca-Cola, you could probably get them to say that 99.9% of people feel that Coca-Cola tastes better than Pepsi. I'm sure they could get you a statistic like that.
Right.
Not feeling there's a lot of skepticism. But what if HIV tests were only 80% accurate? You know, how could a mainstream scientist deal with something like that? That 20% of the people they diagnose aren't really infected and therefore should not take AIDS drugs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't know how they would handle something like that. But, you know, there's also a lot of specialization, and I think that's one of the problems. That, I mean, AIDS doctors, practicing doctors, I doubt that they read very much about anything at all and just accept official guidelines. And,
well,
you know, I don't think that virologists pay much attention to epidemiology.
Mm.
So it's a matter of, again, where they trust what comes from the different specialties.
Well, I think that was quite, I think I detected that in my discussion last week with Dr. Simon Silver, where he studies bacteria, he studies the impact of metals on bacteria, and is an expert in that field. And, you know, he said at one point that nobody should be diagnosed HIV infected on the basis of an antibody test, and
mm-hmm.
yet that's what's been happening up till very recently. Within at the last little while, the CDC is trying to use viral load tests as confirmation, but up till the last few weeks, for, what is that, 30 years now, antibody tests have been used to diagnose people as HIV infected, and on that basis put them on antiretroviral drugs. So it seems like scientists, even though they're specialized in a particular area, don't really mind stepping outside that area and making pronouncements on the basis of trusting what other people have said without really fully understanding it.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed in Silver's article again is that he seemed to know what he was talking about biology and in biology, and mm-hmm. acknowledged that he wasn't that versed in other things. But right at the beginning there, he quoted approvingly a physicist called Robert Park, and he quoted approvingly an article that Irving Langmuir,
right.
had published some 60 years earlier. And actually, neither of those sources is a particularly a good one to cite. Park is terribly dogmatic, and Langmuir's thing was based on a seminar, a private talk that he gave in the lab in his company.
Yes, which reminds me of Thomas Rivers, a famous virologist who tried to redefine Koch's postulates in the 1930s. Did it at a dinner talk at the Bacteriological Society. So it was never a peer-reviewed paper. It was just something he gave to people sitting drinking their coffee after the banquet at a bacteriological meeting, which
right.
seems like kind of a strange place to write something that overturns some postulates that have been accepted for a long time. But maybe it's easier to get people to accept things when they've had a little too much wine to drink and are feeling very full. Nobody's going to stand up and start jumping up and down and saying, that's wrong, that's crazy.
Yeah. The something I read recently about descent from the Big Bang cosmology sent me to a presidential address that Herbert Dingell gave to the Royal Astronomical Society 60 years ago. And one point he made, I think, is an important one, that in the beginnings of modern science, the connection between the evidence and our interpretation of it was very close. You know, we were testing ideas against the actual evidence pretty directly.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, things are incredibly indirect between right. what you're doing and testing the actual theory. I mean, in terms of the HIV/AIDS business, the stretch, or in any medical context, the stretch between things that you do in the lab and what actually goes on in the body, it's an enormous distance with any number of uncertainties in between. So it's actually very difficult nowadays to have conclusive tests of theories and these complicated things.
And by the time you, if it's a new drug, for example, by the time you've got to that point, you may have realized 10 years down the road that you've been causing heart attacks or liver failure or something else like that, and maybe thousands of people have died because of something you didn't think of when you were creating the drug.
That's right, and many of the drugs are actually tested in terms of surrogates of biomarkers. For example, blood pressure is used as a surrogate marker for cardiovascular disease, even though that's not a valid biomarker.
Yeah,
statistical correlation is all.
Right, cholesterol, the same thing.
Yes.
And also, the PSA test is used a lot nowadays, even though that's also highly flawed. I wanted to talk about, when we're talking about science that you're not supposed to talk about, you've studied some things that most scientists, especially the skeptic movement, think is crazy, and you know we shouldn't really talk about them. For example, you've written about the Loch Ness Monster, psychic events, psychic powers, and magnetic healing. So why did you study those, and is that because you believe in them or because you're interested in them? Like, what was the purpose?
Well, it really started with the Loch Ness Monster, and it began when I picked up a book in the library that was called Loch Ness Monster. This was about in the early 1960s. And, of course, I knew that this was a made-up thing that was a scam or a myth or whatever. But when I leafed through the book, there were photographs in there that were supposed to be stills from a film that the author said he'd made. So I thought, could there be anything to this? And so I borrowed the book and I read it and I couldn't make up my mind. And one of the things that I found annoying was that I could not find anything in the scientific literature on that topic. And yet I knew that it was, at that time, Loch Ness Monster was a word that everybody just about recognizes and had heard of. So why could I not find anything authoritative in an encyclopedia or in the scientific literature?
One would imagine that if scientists had rejected the Loch Ness Monster, it was on the basis of some kind of evidence or somebody's written a paper about why this is obviously false. But are you saying that maybe it was rejected out of hand by scientists without ever investigating it?
It was ignored. There had been a lot of public interest in it in the 1930s, and then there was a considerable flurry of interest in the 1960s, and even organized expeditions there. But none of it got into any recognized literature. And that's what got me started. I wondered why science ignored things like that, especially when there were apparently interesting, intriguing bits of evidence, like a moving film. And by the 1970s, there were some intriguing underwater photographs. So at that time, my university was encouraging us to create interdisciplinary research projects. And so I put together a team of a historian and a philosopher of science and a sociologist and a journalist to study the reaction of the scientific community to the issue of the Loch Ness Monster. And we didn't get a grant for that, but several of the reviewers said, if you want to study something substantive like that, why don't you look into the Velikovsky affair?
Okay.
And I'd never heard of it, but I thought I'd better look into it.
Right.
And looking into that, I came to the conclusion that Velikovsky hadn't known what he was talking about, but that also the public criticism of him by people in the scientific community was way off base and not very sound very often.
Right.
And so I decided to write a book about comparing Loch Ness and Velikovsky.
Right.
And through that, I was put in touch with a sociologist, Marcello Truzzi, who specialized in the sociology of out-of-the-way things.
Right.
And so I was put in... I was in a group that founded the Society for Scientific Exploration, which was intended to apply rigorous study of topics like UFOs, psychic phenomena, and so on, that were being ignored in the regular scientific community. And that was a real eye-opener, because I encountered so many highly accomplished, intelligent, impressive people who took seriously things that I dismissed out of hand as being absurd. And I realized that they were looking at me in the same sort of way. How could someone, you know, who's done pretty well in his profession like Henry Bauer, possibly take seriously that a Loch Ness Monster might exist? So that's what set me off on changing my career, really, from doing chemistry to going into what's called science studies, which is sort of amalgam of history and sociology, philosophy of science, and so on, trying to understand what science really is capable of doing and what the interactions are of science and the wider society. And that, of course, led me to want to study particularly unorthodoxies in science, and that's what got me to HIV/AIDS also.
Right. I guess that brings me to another question I asked Simon Silver, which you know, if you study something that later proves to be wrong, and maybe mm-hmm. we can step back 10 years later and say, well, everybody should have seen that it was wrong. But anyway, you didn't know that at the time, so you study something that later turns out to be wrong. Is it possible that in that process you learned things that you wouldn't have learned if you hadn't gone down that path?
No, I think you learn a tremendous number of things, absolutely. You know, it's terribly important to try as much as you can not to get totally captivated by the things that you're interested in. You know, to be able to keep even at the back of your mind that you might actually not be right about that. It's very difficult to do that if your career depends on your being right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the nice thing about doing something like science studies is that you can study these topics as being interesting because people are interested in them. And it doesn't matter whether a particular topic has then turns out to have scientific substance or not to it. It is interesting to try to figure out why people get interested in such things, why they sometimes go overboard on such things, and so on.
And it would seem to me like if say scientists say, you know, Loch Ness Monster, that can't be, that can't exist, you know, which would be my gut reaction. But still, it would seem to be an interesting exercise for the general public to say, these are the reasons why scientists do not believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists. And then put forward a list of things, like the fact that nobody's ever found a dead body of a monster because they presumably die and things like that. There's probably quite a few things that you could put in front of the general public that would help teach them how science should work. You know, a dispassionate look at the evidence, the things you know, the things you don't know, the things you may never know. Putting it together into a logical sequence so that people could look at it and say, well, you know, on the basis of this, it seems obvious that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist, rather than just ignoring it and saying it's beneath us to even talk about that.
Right, several people, including me, have actually taught courses in which we take that approach. We look at some of these topics that are of great public interest, and students tend to be really interested in them,
mm-hmm.
and then say, well, let's look at the evidence and let's discuss it. Let's see where the uncertainties are and what one might be able to do about it.
Yeah, it seems like a good exercise.
I mean, my interest in the Loch Ness Monster forced me or got me to read and to learn a heck of a lot that I had not known about geology
mm-hmm.
and about biology.
Right.
And I think one of the marvelous things about the thing is that there are bits of... there's one film, there are some photographs, and there are many sonar recordings that are very strong evidence that there are some big creatures in Loch Ness. At the mm-hmm. same time, there are excellent reasons why these things cannot be mammals, reptiles, or invertebrates, or insects for that matter. So it's a marvelous mystery. And if you try to look into that mystery, it forces you to learn about all sorts of things.
Right. A similar thing, there's part of the culture wars in the United States is the the belief in evolution versus creationism, or special creationism, sometimes called.
Yeah.
And it seems like the question is, should you teach creationism or just teach evolution? To me, it seems like it's the wrong question, because I think by teaching, it means pouring facts into a young person, and the question is, are those facts, here's evolution, and forget whatever you might have heard from your parents or at church or somewhere else? Or should it be giving children evidence and asking them to discuss how the various theories about the origin of life on Earth, how they can explain the available evidence?
Right. The controversy about that in particular annoys me tremendously, because I think that people really have hidden agendas that they're pushing in both cases.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I studied basically evolutionary biology, and I think that if I had got to that point without having heard and understood the theory, you know, the various theories of creation, I wouldn't have really challenged my understanding of theory of evolution nearly as much. So in a sense, I think it was important to learn about creationism. And it's really, it's kind of futile because you can't forbid people talking about it.
No, but, you know, I wish that people would clarify what it is exactly that they're talking about, because in a lot of cases when people talk, say, evolution, they're really referring to Darwin's idea of natural selection, including the notion of randomness there, whereas what we should do, I think, is to begin with, as you said, the evidence. And let's look at the fossil record, and let's look into what ways we have for estimating the ages of these various things, and how are we going to explain those things?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of powerful lessons that young people could learn, or not necessarily just young people, from sort of saying, well, how do we know that life evolves? You can't see it with your eyes in front of you, so you have to think about it a lot harder.
Exactly, and, you know, this is one of the places to which Dingell's point applies, that the distance between the evidence and the interpretation is considerable. Because the evidence is circumstantial. It's not direct at all.
Right. It also brings up interesting questions about how could you possibly test a theory like evolution when it's something that supposedly happened over millions of years. So how could you run an experiment in a few hours or days that would test whether evolution was correct or not?
Yeah.
I think one of the most brilliant parts of The Origin of Species, if I'm getting the right source, is that Darwin did some experiments where he took highly inbred pigeons. You know, there was a lot of pigeon breeding in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And these pigeons looked entirely different, and he just bred them randomly. And after a few generations, or maybe it was somebody else who did this, but reported by Darwin, and after several generations, he had the Trafalgar Square generic pigeon coming out of it, which was kind of like running evolution backwards, and that you could see how the breeders had, you know, basically killed pigeons they didn't like, and eventually got pigeons that were all white or all some other color or had certain types of feathers.
Yeah.
And so with that, you can see evolution running backwards, and then you can say to yourself, well, running forwards is kind of a logical consequence of this. One of the things that confused me about my discussion with Simon Silver is we talked a little bit about Lamarckism versus epigenetics. Lamarckism being the inheritance of acquired characteristics, and epigenetics meaning the inheritance of cytoplasm. And he made a big distinction between those two things, but I'm not sure that there's such a big distinction between them.
Yeah, I actually listened to that that part of your talk, and I wondered about that, and wondered whether his objection to it was that the original Lamarckian idea was pretty simple-minded, in the sense of if a creature is eating things on high branches and they keep stretching, you know, having a long neck is favorable, then, you know, their offspring will automatically have longer necks.
Right.
Whereas in the epigenetics, there isn't the same direct connection between how the genetic change comes about and what it results in.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, but if it seems like epigenetics to me is a subset of the Lamarckian idea, is a much more limited set, but could mean that the environment could have a significant influence on...
Right, or you could say that Lamarck's notion was a subset of the epigenetic mechanism that we now recognize, that things that happen during during the lifetime of something can be passed on genetically.
Yeah, and it does seem pretty important. Like if an animal or plant grows in a cold climate, can that hand off some better capabilities to grow in a cold climate to its offspring? And would this be useful in animal or plant breeding? It seems like it would be an interesting area of study, but it seems go ahead.
Is that actually the case, that the environment has that direct an effect on how the epigenetic change is made?
No, I don't think that that's been proven at present, but I'm just saying if you could understand it better, maybe you could take advantage of some of this, but it seemed there was a bit of a sleight of hand going on, where Lamarckism is bad because we're all told it's bad, but epigenetics is okay, but just we don't want to talk about the fact that really they're two overlapping concepts.
Right.
If somebody put down the word Lamarckism on a piece of paper, we reject it out of hand. If you put down epigenetics, you could probably say the same thing, and people would say, oh, that's really interesting.
Yes. I got that impression of Silver, too, the same impression as the fellow who wrote you that long email had, that, you know, that he's just a bit too sure of himself.
Yeah, and I think that's sadly very common in science, and I think it gets stronger the more money is involved. I don't think Dr. Silver is in a particularly well-paid corner of science. He's not in HIV/AIDS or cancer or something like that. But this tendency seems to exist everywhere, that everything has to be defined as good or bad, inside or outside, acceptable or unacceptable, and I don't see a lot of gray areas where there's
I think it's difficult to overemphasize what a cutthroat business research is nowadays. Everybody needs a grant, and if you're in biology and applying to the NIH, your chances of getting a grant are less than one in five.
Yeah.
So people,
yes.
And it's life and death, because 10-year promotion and so on all depend on it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Bauer, we've come to the end of our hour, or very close to it, and so I'd just like to thank you for a very stimulating conversation, and I hope our audience finds it as interesting as I did. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having it, having me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks, Henry. Bye-bye.
Okay, Dave.